Cemetery Road is a break, not because it's not intense. It's intense, but it's not as daunting in terms of being an epic novel that deals with the darkest things in the world. It deals with good old garden variety, murder and corruption and illicit romance.
Marginalia.
Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to the main topic
in the margin of a book.
Readers familiar with Greg Iles know that, although he writes mysteries and thrillers, they are anything but formulaic. Rich with detail, Iles can maintain quality while straddling commercial and literary fiction for hundreds and hundreds of pages. His last trilogy ended up over 2,400 pages. His latest work, a standalone thriller titled Cemetery Road, isn't quite so long, but at 587 pages, it's more than average work in the genre. And at an intense 587 pages, there is nothing quick about it. I recently spoke with Greg Iles via Skype to talk about Cemetery Road, avoiding spoilers since it was just released on March 5th. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation. I don't often ask authors to read from their books, but I would very much like for you to read chapter one. And before listeners revolt by pushing stop or forward, let me offer this reassurance. It's only 103 words. Can you read that for us, Greg?
Yes. Chapter one. I never meant to kill my brother. I never set out to hate my father. I never dreamed I would bury my own son. Nor could I have imagined that I would betray the childhood friend who saved my life or win a Pulitzer Prize for telling a lie. All these things I have done, yet most people I know would call me an honorable man. I wouldn't go that far, but I try to be a good man, and most of the time I believe I succeed. How is this possible? These are complicated times, and it's not easy to be good.
Wow, that's just a fantastic first line, first paragraph, first chapter, everything all in one.
Thank you.
I wanted to kind of set up the book for the readers. Cemetery Road is a novel set in Benville, Mississippi. And did I say that right?
You said it close enough.
Yes. How do you say it?
Benville.
Okay. It's set in Benville, Mississippi.
Good.
Oh, thank you. I looked for it on a map. Is it a fictional town?
It is. It's a fictitious town. For the first time in more than 10 years, I'm using a fictional town. But I've created such a dense historical context for it and background. I try to get things to the point where not even a historian would know. But Beth, here's my worry. We have a lot of tourists who come to Natchez from all over the world because of my Natchez Burning trilogy. And I'm scared to death we're going to get the tourists riding up and down Highway 61 in the Mississippi River looking for Benville, and it won't be there. I don't know what to do about that.
Well, that's okay. They can keep looking because, you know, the town is as much a character as any other in the book. This fictional town sits on the Mississippi River across from Louisiana, and it has seen better days. Can you talk to me a little bit about the town?
Yeah, as far as sort of the external setting and the trappings of the book, it's set in a shrinking river town that's hit the tipping point, sort of. And there's several of those in Mississippi that used to sort of be jewels on the Mississippi River, and now they're not. And I find when I've been in Ohio and different places, you know, the steel towns are like that. These towns, they thrived up through the 60s and 70s, and then they began to shrink. And now they've hit a tipping point, and people are really desperate. And that provided a good fictional grounding for the kind of book that I write.
Now, the main character, the man whose words you just read, is Marshall McEwen, and he's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who is returning home to Benville to help his mother care for his ailing father and also help run the newspaper that has been in his family for 150 years. And that is, you know, that's heavy enough. But then here's where trying to describe the story with no spoilers, no less, becomes tricky because there are so many layers. There are quite a few layers and sub-stories in the book. And so I just wanted to maybe poke at a few of them without spoilers, of course. So,
sure.
Like the McEwen family and the various losses they've suffered through the years. That's one storyline in and of itself.
Yeah, I grew up with families like that. You know, I mean, we all know that even if you lead a blameless life in this world, tragedy's going to find you somehow. And some families seem to endure more than their share of tragedy and loss. But you know, as you know, without too many spoilers, the father blamed the son for one of the tragedies in their family. And so he left at 18, swearing never to come home. But when he has to come home to help his mother, it brings him back to this place where he was a different person. And as you know, I mean, we can give this much away. This book, when you strip away the crime and the thriller part, it's really about two men who love the same woman, you know, two childhood friends. One left, swearing he'd never come back. The other went to the military, then came home and married the woman they both loved. And so when they all end up in the same town again at about the age of 45, it's a recipe for trouble, needless to say.
And, you know, you talk about these two friends, Marshall and his friend Paul. They also spent time in Iraq. So that's another story layer on top of this. I mean, how much research did you have to do?
Well, you know, a lot I do, but that's nothing new for me. I mean, I'm one of the few writers who's really written in a lot of different genres within the broad genre, I guess, of thrillers or mystery, whatever you call it. I've written books set in World War II and the Holocaust. I've written about childhood sexual abuse, civil rights murders, very close to reality. So research for me is it's just old hat almost. And so the Iraq part, the great thing about that was two guys wound up there. One is a soldier, a military contractor. The other is a journalist. So in a sense, they were on opposite sides, yet because they were childhood friends, it put them in a situation where, let's just say, one could save the other's life. That's all we'll give away. But it complicates everything that comes later.
So another character, I'm not sure how much we want to reveal about her, but she plays a huge role, is Jet.
If you finish the book, you probably have conflicting feelings about Jet. I'm very curious how female readers are going to react, because this book, really, a lot of people ask how books begin and do you know the end at the beginning, and every book is different, but this book really was built around the shocking secret that's revealed at the end about what Jet did in her life. And I don't think people will even believe it. I'm sure nobody will guess it in terms of the real reason she did what she did. And I'm curious to see what women think. But that's the kind of thing I like to explore, you know, the unusual, yet it's still within the realm of something people can relate to.
Well, and I also feel like we have to touch on this group of 12 men, the Bienville Poker Club.
The Bienville Poker Club. So let's see. This is Wichita, right?
Yes, yes, we are.
So there, you know, Kansas, there was a lot of conflicting currents in the Civil War. Mississippi was the Deep South, obviously. But these are 12 guys who go all the way back to the pre-war years. Their ancestors were very powerful. And when the Civil War was lost and Yankees were coming south for Reconstruction and African Americans were sent into the Congress for the first time, instead of reacting by putting sheets over their head and going out and burning crosses, these guys very quietly got and kept their hands on the levers of business in the town, so that when Reconstruction ended, they really were in control of everything, and they've maintained that control through the present day. And that's not so unrealistic. You get some new money, as you saw is in the book, through the casino owner, and nouveau riche people can get in. But in the South, there are little towns that are still very much controlled by the old blue blood money. And I wanted to show that, you know, it's a pernicious influence, but especially living through the time we're living in today, we know what it means to have a few powerful people control things.
You didn't shy away from a lot of these issues either. I mean, there was a lot of racial tension in this book. There were a lot of politics.
I've gotten in politics and involved in the last about 3 or 4 years, really, and on the local level and recently on at least the state Senate level, behind the scenes, but working in communications or just anonymously helping with speeches and things like that. And man, I have seen things I just couldn't believe. I mean, politics, that's a rough sport, maybe the roughest sport, and people are willing to do quite a lot to get power, to maintain power. And I mean, with all the things I've written about, I mean, after spending 10 years writing that trilogy about the darkest chapters of civil rights in Mississippi, you know, I'm not going to shy away from anything. So I want to show, I may even do another political novel after this, really.
You know, oftentimes commercial fiction, especially mysteries and thrillers. They're chock full of dialogue and not much of anything else. But Cemetery Road is not a skimming book. It's thoughtful.
No.
it requires readers to be thoughtful. I marked quite a few passages that were just so literary, and you maintained that level of detail and quality for 587 pages. And this is short
compared to
some of your other more recent work. How does your writing and like writing to editing process work? Do you start like with 1,200 pages that you fine tune down to 600, or how does your first draft compare with your last?
You're reading the first draft, Beth.
No.
No, yeah, really. I go most of the year without writing anything, and the story's working itself out sort of in my subconscious. And by the time I sit down to write, I say, in all frankness, I say it's like a pregnant woman when her water breaks. That story's coming no matter what. The first day I sit down to write, I write 12 hours, and by the end, I'm writing it 20 and 30 hours at a time. A good day for me is 5,000 or 6,000 words in a day, and I don't go back very much and change anything, you know?
And that was just first draft. That's incredible.
I would say a lot of my books, my agent says, Greg, don't ever say this. You just cause me a nightmare with every beginning writer because they don't want to edit. But really, many of my books have been what I would call a draft and a half. I mean, think about it. To put out a book every 18 months or 2 years, and my books are generally three times longer than a standard thriller, when would you think I would have time to go back and rewrite it? I don't, you know? It just, I wish I did. I mean, my early books where I really took a solid 2 years, books like The Quiet Game, you can go back to those and pick almost any passage and read it aloud. And there's some what I call lapidary prose in those books. I think there are passages in the new books where I get some really good things and I get lucky. But in general, what I do is trade precision for intensity. I could probably make almost any page of this book better if I sat down, you know, for a couple of hours. I don't have time to do that. But what I get with the method that I use is I actually live through the story in real time with those characters. And so when we come to scenes where characters die or are in severe conflict or it's emotional, I'm sitting there with tears running down my face and living through it. And I think that gets through to the reader, you know.
And how long have you been working on this book? I mean, how long was the writing process for it?
Well, I started out, I worked on a different book for about 4 or 5 months. I thought about it and started it and then decided I didn't want to do that. So I ate up part of my available time on a different book. So certainly this whole book was produced in less than a year. And the actual writing was a good bit less than that, maybe 7 months or something.
Wow.
6 months. I don't recommend that. You know, writers do it all a different way, you know. I'm friends with John Grisham. John writes the first page of the new novel on the day he writes the last one of the present novel. And he writes a good, sane, steady 5-6 pages a day. And that's how you ought to do it. Scott Turow writes a lot more than he uses, you know, and he really distills down. I have this sort of insane method, but the point is it really doesn't matter how you do it, so long as you succeed in what you're trying to do.
At one point in the book, one of your characters was asking another why he was involving, quote, that bookstore lady who hasn't done a damn thing to you and whose coffee I like.
Somebody suggested I take that line out. I thought that was a great line.
I loved it. I read that and I laughed out loud. And I just wanted to know, I mean, do you just have fun when you write?
Yeah. I mean, look, you gotta, when you're doing this, you can't sit here and think. You can't overthink it like you're writing some hyper-dramatic thing. You have to treat people how they really are. And I think that's the genius sometimes of shows like The Sopranos or True Detective or like The Godfather in the famous scene, you know, take the cannoli, leave the gun. It's those little human details that make everything real.
So this is a standalone book. Do you ever wonder what those characters are doing now?
Those characters live in me. I how I told you I think most of the year and then the stories work themselves out. So in a weird way, that universe of Cemetery Road exists within me now, and I can be doing something else. And those characters are sort of tapping me, telling me, here's what I'm doing. And that's how the second thing takes shape. You know, I told you I'd been working in politics a little bit, and I mentioned in Cemetery Road that there's a mayoral election coming up in the city. And I see a lot of things happening that I've experienced recently that you just wouldn't believe. So, and you know, if it's a good enough story, it'll be insistent tapping away at me until I can't resist it anymore. If people have stuck with me, if they're familiar with my trilogy, and which really ended up being over 2,400 pages, when I started writing that, I was young, and when I finished, I felt old. You know, I had no gray hair. My kids were in middle school. When I got out, I was down to one leg. My kids were in college and law school. You know, I needed a break. Cemetery Road is a break, not because it's not intense. It's intense, but it's not as daunting in terms of being an epic novel that deals with the darkest things in the world. It deals with good old garden variety murder and corruption and illicit romance. And I think it's a good introduction to me if people haven't read it.
That was Greg Iles, author of the book Cemetery Road, which was published by William Morrow. Iles will be in Wichita on Monday, March 18th at a Bode venue. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Discover more episodes at KMUW.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Marginalia is produced at KMUW Wichita. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen, and I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.